turn to the book of Ezekiel.
Yes, Ezekiel. Chapter 14. I empathize with Isaac playing the trombone. About your age, I was trying to do the same thing in front of people. Ezekiel chapter 14 and verses 12 to 14. When God is looking for examples of righteousness and people he can hold up as examples, notice whom he chooses in our verses here. Ezekiel 14, 12. The word of the Lord came again to me, saying, Son of man, when a land sins against me by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. I will cut off its supply of bread, send famine on it, and cut off man and beast from it. Though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves by their righteousness, says the Lord. As God looks for three examples of righteousness, he picks these three men. And so we're going to look at one of them today, Job. And so would you turn now to the book of Job. Also in the New Testament, James 5:11, God uses Job as an example. Consider the patience, or the better translation, better the perseverance, the steadfastness of Job. So here in the first chapter of the book of Job, we see God's opinion of this man here. And so just a few little background things about Job. Job was a real man, obviously, probably lived in the time of Abraham or the patriarchs. We come to that conclusion because there's no reference to the Mosaic law or the tabernacle temple or the Mosaic system, no priesthood at all in the book of Job. In fact, Job acts as priest for his family. His long life indicates, again, he was living back then. There was not the effects of genetic entropy at that point yet. He probably lived, we don't know exactly, but he lived 140 years after his trials. And before those trials, he had 10 children. So he probably lived around 200 years, I would think, 2 years, which was typical at the time, because Abraham lived 175, Isaac lived 180, Terah, Abraham's father, lived 205. So he fits in very well with that. He gave an inheritance to his daughters, which in the time of the Mosaic system, you only gave your inheritance to your sons. He lived in a time when wealth was measured in terms of livestock, and that was typical at the time of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. There are several Hebrew words that are used here that are typical of that time, and especially in Genesis 17:1, God revealed himself to Abram as El Shaddai. And that word Shaddai is used 31 times in the book of Job. It's the typical name for God used in this book. And also there's several personal and place names used here that are associated with the patriarchal times. So he lived, I think probably at that time, he lived in the land of Uz, which is southeast of the Dead Sea. Lamentations 4:21 identifies it with Edom. The Greek general Ptolemy in the 3rd century B.C. identified this area as Uz. So this is just a little bit where he lived and when he lived. Now let's read the first chapter together, and then I want to make 10 simple statements about this man. Job chapter 1. There was a man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, and one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. So that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. Now his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them. And he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, it may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts. Thus Job did regularly. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where do you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth, and from walking back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There's none like him on the earth. Blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. So Satan answered the Lord and said, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him and around his household and around all that he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has. He will surely curse you to your face. So the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person. Then Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. And a messenger came to Job and said, the men were plowing and the donkeys feeding beside them when the Sabaeans raided them and took them away. Indeed, they have killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, the fire of God fell from heaven and turned and burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another came and said, the Chaldeans formed 3 bands, raided the camels and took them away, yes, and killed the servants with the edge of the sword. And I alone have escaped to tell you. While he was still speaking, another also came and said, your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their eldest brother's house, and suddenly a great wind came from across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house and fell on the young men, and they're all dead. And I alone have escaped to tell you. Then Job arose, tore his robe, and shaved his head. He fell to the ground and worshipped. He said, naked I came from my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. In all this, Job did not sin or charge God with wrong. I'd like to take up the Lord's challenge here this morning and consider Job. Have you considered my servant Job? Let's consider him. And I see 10 things we can say about Job. in this first chapter of just the first chapter of this book. First of all, he was a God-fearing man. That is cited from three different sources. You notice that? The writer of the book says that he feared God and shunned evil. God said it, and Satan said it, recognized it. What does it mean to fear God? I'd like to suggest three things. To fear God is to have a consciousness of God, an awareness of God. That we're aware of God every day, even when we work, when we're driving, when we're in our home washing dishes. There's an awareness of God. Because most people, unsaved people, they just go through the day, they don't even think about God at all. I think secondly, and that's more than just believing God exists, this idea of fearing God. But we're always living in his knowledge and under his observation. Secondly, I think there's a respect for God. The fear of God means a respect for God. We acknowledge his greatness, his divine attributes, his sovereign creationship, and we use his names with caution and with carefulness. I've heard Christians use the name of the Lord in a flippant way. I remember hearing a radio preacher years ago, kind of a charismatic kind of a guy. Every other sentence he was saying, "Hallelujah." I think that's a very special name to say that. Praise Jehovah. We use God's name with respect. I read the Jewish newspaper in Rochester, the Jewish Ledger, and every week they have a little Bible study in the paper. And it's someone in Jerusalem writes it. But when they come to the name of God, they will not spell it out totally. It's G/D. It's a way of trying to respect God's name. I think we need to be careful about that too. And so we have a respect for God. And thirdly, I think there's a submission to God. Knowing his greatness and our finiteness, we humble ourselves before him. We don't promote ourselves, we promote God. And you've met people who only talk about themselves. And it's not a very edifying conversation usually. We acknowledge God, we're aware of him, we respect him, and we submit ourselves to him. And it's interesting, in Romans chapter 1, it says the fear of God is absent from the fallen world. There's no fear of God. And in the early church, it was characterized by the fear of God. Acts 9:31, they were walking in the fear of the Lord. And we should be people who are Christians, that we walk in the fear of the Lord. And this would mark true believers, because the fear of the Lord is the beginning, right, of wisdom and of knowledge. So he was a God-fearing man. Secondly, we can say that Job was a right-living man. Now, this is the other side of the coin, isn't it? When a person fears God, then they shun evil. Job 28:28, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. Proverbs 8:13, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. Proverbs 16:6, by the fear of the Lord, one keeps away from evil. And so thus God called him a blameless man, not perfect, but blameless and upright. And these words were also applied to Noah, by the way, and Abraham and Daniel. So he's a right living man. Righteous means to live according to right. How did he know what was right at this point in history? There was no Mosaic law yet. That's a ways off yet. How did he know what was right living, what was wrong living? Well, because according to Romans chapter 1, there's a basic knowledge of God that's inherent in us as God's creation. Basic right and wrong is written in the human heart. And there had been divine revelation from Adam on. There's been divine revelation, little by little. Look, when it comes time of the judgment of the Noahic flood, it assumes the people knew what was right and what was wrong, because it says the people were wicked, evil, and corrupt. Well, you had to have standards of right and wrong to know what was evil and corrupt. So he was righteous, right living. Noah was called that, by the way, as well, and also Lot, interestingly, was called a righteous man. 2 Peter talks about that. What does right living involve? What does it mean to live right, to be righteous? Well, there's five qualities that should be in my life and should be in your life as a Christian. Righteousness involves honesty. You don't steal, you don't cheat. That seems so simple, but it's not simple. People are doing it all the time. Honesty. Secondly, morality. There's no premarital or extramarital sex. I used to think everybody knew that, in the Christian world even. Morality. Thirdly, charity. Righteousness means being kind to people. In word and in deed. This world is getting so harsh and so brutal in our words. People are cutting other people up. I think we need to be kind. That's part of righteousness. That we treat people with respect because they're all made in the image and likeness of God. Right, Brother Tim? We'll talk about that tonight. Fourthly, righteousness, I think, involves fidelity. It means you keep your word. Keep your promises. I've had, over the years, Christians make a promise to me and never keep it. They say, I'm going to do something, don't do it. That's part of righteousness. We are dependable in what we say and do. And lastly, responsibility. We fulfill our obligations. And we do it with dedication and thoroughness. So those things, those five qualities, I think, are part of what it means to be right living. Many a Christian's testimony has been marred by a violation of some of these things. And they're not listening to our testimony because of something that we have done that was unrighteous. So he was a God-fearing man and a right-living man, Job was. If there was a person who should not have faced what Job faced, it was whom? Job. He didn't deserve, the health and wealth gospel says, these things don't happen to real dedicated Christians. So he was a paragon of God-fearing, of a God-fearing, righteous-living person. And look what's going to happen to him. By the way, do people know you as being a righteous, God-fearing person in your job, at work, in your community? In your family? Now, they may have another word for you. She's very religious. Or he's very strict. They called me Elmer Gantry when I was in the Army. Any of the old folks know who that is? Boy, that must go back real far. He was a Shakespeare preacher in a Western movie years ago, Elmer Gander. So anyhow, I took it as a backhanded compliment. So he was that kind of a person. Let me go into a third thing about him. He was a wealthy man. In five different ways, he was wealthy. He was wealthy in children. It's interesting. In the book of Ruth, when the women talk to Naomi, they say Ruth is better to you than what? Seven sons. How many sons did Job have? Seven. That was the ideal. See? Seven. In 1 Samuel 2:5, Hannah says the barren gives birth to seven. So he was wealthy in children, he was wealthy in possessions, and we have the enumeration here of all his livestock. You know, it's a lot of livestock to take care of. In fact, Satan in verse 10 refers to Job's increasing wealth. He was wealthy in servants. The King James says very great household. These were his servants. I mean, with all the livestock he had, he needed a lot of workers. Probably some of them were like his little militia as well to protect them from the marauding Sabaeans and Chaldeans. He was rich in influence and renown. Verse 3 talks about that, well known and respected. And lastly, he was wealthy in family harmony. I see that in verse 4, 13 and 18. It seems they had a schedule of family gatherings rotated among the sons. Probably these are birthday parties, I suppose, or birthday feasts of some kind in their time, and the sisters to come and join. Fourthly, Job was a concerned man. See this in verse 5. What was he concerned about? All his possessions, all his livestock? Was he concerned about his fame? Was he concerned about his comfort? He was concerned about his sons and his daughters. You see this here. Job's heart was turned toward his children. You know what the last verse of the Old Testament is? It's about the ministry of the coming Elijah. Elijah will do what? Turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers. Job was a man whose heart was turned toward his children. And they were close to him as well. So he was concerned about his sons and his daughters. He was concerned about their spiritual welfare. He was concerned that his sons may have sinned by cursing God. That's interesting. The Hebrew verb here is blessed, that they may have blessed God. Barak. I think it's the idea of using God's name flippantly. Like people do today, use God's name flippantly. And he was concerned about they may have said something flippantly about God and discounted God in their celebrations. He was not concerned about their health or their finances or their reputation or their school achievement or their social popularity. He was concerned about their spiritual lives. When I came to West Endicott Baptist Church in 1980, Judy and I both started teaching Sunday school classes. She taught the Bethany class. The lady came and asked, would you teach the Bethany class? What's this, the Bethany class? That's the old ladies' class. So she started, I wanted her to teach that class anyhow. And I started teaching the young adult class because Judy and I were convinced that strong churches are built upon strong marriages and strong homes. And so I began teaching young adult. She had about 20 in her class, I had about 20 in my class. These were college career singles, married couples without children, and married couples with children. And right away, I handed them a sheet, a questionnaire. I wanted to get to know them because I was brand new there. And, you know, give us your name, address, where you come from, where you were born, what education do you have, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the questions I asked was, what are your goals for your children? If you have children, what are your goals? And if you do, God gives you children, what are your goals for your children? And I took those 20 questionnaires and read them over. I was disappointed. They said that they'd be happy. I want our children to be successful. I want our children to have a good marriage. And things like that. And I thought to myself, if I had gone to 20 unsaved people, they would have said the same things. Not one of them had any spiritual goal for their children. That they come to know Christ and live for Christ. That they have a Christian marriage, Christian mate. And I want to talk to you young folks with children. I know some of you folks when you were kids. I care about you. What are your goals for your kids? Can you write it out? These are my goals for my children. And this is how we're going to accomplish it. I gave Stephen and Lisa a plaque when they were married from 3 John. I have no greater joy than to hear my children walk in the truth. And Job was wealthy, and he was concerned about his kids. One more thing here I see in verse 5. He was concerned about sacrificial atonement. He knew that the only covering for sin was through a substitutionary blood sacrifice. How did he know that? Well, God gave us the pattern with Adam and Eve. He slew the animals to cover them, right? Abel's offering was an offering of animals. Noah sacrificed animals on an altar. Abraham, in his time, built altars. So they knew, and he knew, this is the way you approach God. This is how you have your sins forgiven. You have to have a substitute shed his blood in my place. And so he was following that precedent as he offers sacrifices here in verse 5 for his children. And this cost them time and money, obviously. And Job's kids knew this is how you get right with God, through that sort of sacrifice. Let me go on to another thing we can say about him. He was a consistent man. One word here in verse 5 is so powerful to me. You know what that word is? Regularly. Thus Job did regularly. Or other translations, continually. He was consistent in his spiritual exercises. Are you consistent in your spiritual disciplines? In Bible reading, prayer? In church attendance? Pastor mentioned a couple weeks ago, if you attend church once a Sunday, you're considered a regular evangelical, a consistent evangelical today. Once? Do you go to work once every 4 days? He was consistent. And if you're not consistent, what do people call you? Hypocrite. Because it doesn't mean that much to you. Hypocrite, or you're unfaithful. Your convictions will show up in consistency. What you really believe will show in your practices, what you do. And the worst thing is if your own kids, say dad or mom, are hypocrites. They say this, but it doesn't really carry over into real life. Well, our practices, what we do consistently, shows what we believe. Let me go on to the sixth thing here. Job was an oblivious man. What do you mean by that? Job did not know about the drama going on in heaven between God and Satan. Job did not know that Satan was out to get him, that Satan was accusing people of their sins. Job did not know that God was offering him as an example of a righteous person. And so all this is going on in Job's life, all these tragedies, and he does not know what's going on in heaven. He's oblivious to it. That's a reminder, there are bigger things going on in our lives than we realize. There's things that are going on that we cannot understand and that we have no right to understand. God is not obligated to give us an explanation of what happens. Did he ever do it with Job? Never did. Never did. Never did. Now we want to know, well, why? Our big question is, why, Lord, why? God is not obligated. That's the whole point of the book of Job. Just trust me, based on who I am. Seventhly, Job was a hated man. Hated? Yeah, he was hated. By whom? Satan. We see this over and over again in this chapter. In fact, the word Satan occurs seven times in this first chapter, and the word means adversary or accuser, and the article occurs before it's the adversary, the accuser. Remember Revelation 12:10, he's the accuser of our brethren. Satan is the Christian's adversary in heaven and on earth. And he implies in verse 9, he implies that Job serves God from selfish motives. Verse 10, he implies that Job serves God only when things are going well materially. Satan maligns Job and he wants to destroy him. See what he says here. He'll curse you to your face. Stretch out your hand, he'll curse you to your face. By taking away his possessions and his servants. And of course, in the next chapter, he wants to take away his life, too. He wants Job to curse God. We need to realize we are in a spiritual battle. There are principalities and powers and rulers of darkness of this world, the spiritual wickedness in the heavenlies that are against us. And in our prayer life, we need to actively battle Satan. We're to do what? Resist the devil. Don't give place to the devil. It's interesting in Ephesians there. Don't give, the word is topos. Don't give ground to Satan. You get the word topography from that. Every Christian's in a spiritual warfare, as Ephesians 6 talks about. So we're to resist the devil. We're to be sober. We've given no opportunities to Satan. And Job said, there's someone out there who hates you. And if we didn't have the Lord and bring to the resources of God into our lives, we would be a loser and a done for. And that's the next thing I want to mention here. Job was a protected man. Satan would have taken Job's life, but he had God's protection. Remember, it says in verse 10 there, you've done what? Put a hedge around him. I have several relatives years ago who were farmers down in Central Pennsylvania. And they had hedgerows. Remember what that? Hedgerows. What were they for? Well, they marked the boundaries of your property, and they also kept out intruders and animals. Sometimes animals going through from one field to the next field. And God had put a hedgerow around them. We do that today with our houses. We put briar bushes outside our windows. He had God's protection, and he had God's limitation. You can only do this, God said. You can do this, but in this first chapter, you can't touch him personally, his body. Next chapter, he's going to give him permission to go to the Father. So there's a protection. That encourages me to know that God's going to only give me what he knows I can handle. We have his protection. We have his hedge around us. Well, let's go to the heart of this whole chapter, I guess. That he was a tried man. Verses 13 through 19 talks about that. That's our ninth statement we can make about him. He was a tried man with tragedies. Now, these were not just little things. These are major things. These are the kind of things they get on the TV news. These are not normal things at all. It's interesting. They were all orchestrated by Satan for maximum impact. So these tragedies were multiple tragedies. The Sabaeans come, steal the oxen, the donkeys kill the servants. One survives to tell about it. Verse 16, the sheep and the servants are killed from above. Verse 17, the Chaldeans come and steal the camels and kill the servants, except for the one who was able to come back and give the report. And then I think this is the worst of all. And verse 18, you know, people, you've heard the people, after a tornado destroys a house or something, and the people say, but that's all stuff. Thank God they protected. My kids survived. We have family survived. They realized what was important was family. Now he's lost his family, his kids. Seven sons from this wind. I can't imagine what. I don't know if any of you have lost a child. I had a dear family in our church in Michigan. Their daughter just died about 2 years ago from brain cancer. And we visited with them, and she was still heartbroken to lose a daughter. Here, they lost, Job lost all his kids. So these are overwhelming tragedies. Financial ruin, family deaths, servants died except for the four. Financial, physical, emotional, spiritual suffering. And then, as Satan had it all worked out, they were simultaneous tragedies. While he was yet speaking, can you imagine blow after blow after blow after blow? But lastly, Job was a worshiping man. These verses here at the end. Then Job arose, verse 20, tore his robe, shaved his head, fell to the ground, and did what? Worships. By the way, when you see instances of worship in the Bible, generally there's nothing to do with music. Nothing to do with music. He worshiped, and he said, what? He worshipped. Notice he worshipped in good times with his sacrifices before. He was worshiping God. And now he's worshiping in bad times. I would just suggest your relationship to God in the good times will determine how well you do in the bad times. you better work on it now while things are good. And this, what he says here in verse 21 and 22 is, to me, is one of the most amazing theological statements in all the world. This was his philosophy of life. This is what he believed, and it comes out here in the tragedies. I see here again five great theological statements. These were his basic convictions. These were his tenets of faith. Number one, God gives all. Things and people, God gives. That wife, God gave you. Those children, God gave you. Those things, God gave you. We are what? Stewards of everything. We don't own anything. We're stewards. And he, that was his first statement of faith. God gives all. Secondly, it's the spiritual that matters. We begin naked and we end naked. That's all. That doesn't matter. It's the spiritual. It's the things you can't see that matter. The third element of his convictions, all things and people are transitory. The Lord gave, the Lord took away. Things just pass away, they're past. Everything in this world is going to happen. What's going to happen to it? Well, it's all going to be burned up. It's transitory. Fourth element, God is in control of all things. It's Jehovah who gave. And it's a Jehovah who took away. And therefore, our goal in life is to worship God. That's what life's all about, worshiping God. He fell into worship. He's a worshiping man. And please notice, Job grieved. When you lose a love, when you lose a loved one, you grieve. He tore his robe and shaved his head. The loss of his possessions did not entail the loss of his faith. Grief might have changed his appearance, it could not change his heart. Trust does not mean we do not grieve. Can I give you an illustration of recent contemporary faith like Job's? I'm hoping I can get through this. My wife, Judy. I would not ever suggest that she faced what Job faced. But when she's about 40, she discovered that she had a genetic disease, captainuria. And from that point on, she gradually and increasingly and inexorably faced the loss of comfort, loss of mobility, the loss of the ability to play the piano, and then the loss of being able to breathe. Spent the last years on a BiPAP machine. I'm going to say, to God's glory, I was able to witness the grace of God in a person's life. She never complained, never questioned God, never became difficult to live with, always the sweet, wonderful person she always was. And trusted the Lord. And she had a verse of scripture she had printed out on a 3x5 card. She had it back of the sink, because she liked to still. I'd lift her up to the sink so she could do the dishes. Like to do the dishes. And it was Psalm 119, verse 75. I know, O Lord, that thy judgments are right, and thou in faithfulness hath afflicted me. And we were privileged as a family to see Job-like faith in our modern world. And this story of Job, we think of Job's faith, you know. But I must say, there's something more amazing about this whole story. It's not that Job put his faith in God, but that God put his faith in Job. He knew that, he believed he could trust Job with these trials, and he would not curse God. I like to think that God trusted my Judy with trials to demonstrate his grace and his power, and to make someone beautiful and sweet in the midst of trouble. And of course, the question I have here is, could God make me a test case? Whew, I'm sure I would volunteer for that. But I do pray that God would increase my faith and grow my faith. And I'd like to make this hymn text my prayer. Oh, for a faith that will not shrink, though pressed by many a foe, that will not tremble on the brink of any earthly woe, that will not murmur nor complain beneath the chastening rod, but in the hour of grief or pain, will lean upon its God. Is that your prayer? It's my prayer. That God will stretch my faith, increase my faith, and not let it falter in the hour of trial. That we will end well. Dear Father, I'm grateful again for this man Job. As we've considered him, you've invited us to consider him. And that these qualities of his life would be evident in our lives as we submit ourselves to you and humble ourselves before you. Bless again each one of us, that we might be known as people of Job-like faith. Help those who suffer, those who have gone through grief, those who have had loss, and we have questions. We wonder, Lord, help us to just trust you. Help us to know you better, so we can trust the heart of God as well as the hand of God. We pray in his name.